The call back to order the House Judiciary Committee. Are there any other questions or comments? If not, we will pull this bill over and check with the Department of Law on a particular issue. Yes, Representative.
Sure, I'd like to put on the record. Does this go anywhere after here?
No.
Okay. What we're trying to do is respond to Mr. Mudkayne's concern about these kids clogging up the facilities with these orders that show failure to appear warrants. We feel that a good case could be made that the parent, he or she is notified of the citation in the first place by statute, it is their responsibility to be there, and that we can get them in and not clog up the juvenile facility and really get the right person into court anyway. But we need to run a couple of things by the Department of Law. We'll try to do that as efficiently as possible. It's still getting.
Yeah.
Okay.
This does go to finance. It has a fiscal.
Well, I think this still would be better done here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But I just want to let it isn't going on the floor from here.
Representative Roper.
I apologize because of my lack of attendance here, but did you get into the whole issue about why the elderly and disabled only were identified for community work? Was that brought up in the?
It doesn't mean only, but it in communities, in rural communities, they felt that this was where the services could be used.
We're holding the bill over anyway.
Yeah, but if you didn't, I mean, it seems like a restrictive element, and I appreciate that. I'd like to get into that some further. Maybe I can do that outside, but I appreciate that. I just want to bring that up. I've got some concerns about that.
Okay, so we will revisit that probably. Well, I don't know if we can get a hold of the Department of Law this afternoon or not. We can try and revisit that on Monday. We'll advise you.
Okay, thank you.
That brings us back to House Bill 234, and there, the sponsor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and lady and gentlemen of the Judiciary Committee. I'm glad that we did have the opportunity to let the two people in Anchorage give testimony. I understand that no one else is up there, so it looked like it paid off to let them this morning.
We have not heard of anybody else wanting to testify, and I don't believe we have anybody signed up.
We have one in the audience.
Oh, we do? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, now that we have a little more time and you're not rushed to get to session, I want to give a little more detail of why this bill developed the way it did. Over the years, people have been offended with the public paying for elective services, especially abortions. And it's become even more apparent today that the stigma to abortion is not what it used to be. It's perhaps being more accepted, although that people do not feel that they should pay for someone's free choice in a case like this. And especially when there are moral people who feels that this really offends them, that government is involved in this type of elective medical procedures, and why should they pay? Well, today, we have developed laws within the state of Alaska, and they've been supported by the federal government. Matter of fact, the federal government says that a person, a male, responsible for a child out of wedlock, and if the mother goes wherever they go, is responsible for the rest of that life, or at least until the age 18, for that child's well-being. And this comes under the Child Enforcement Services, and I've been looking at those bills issues for a long time and helping them to support a responsible male. Then it developed the idea where if they're going to be responsible for the child that is allowed to be born, why not be responsible especially for the abortion when it competes against other medical needs of our society? In the last couple years, the governor has made it the big to-do about not enough money and for children to have eyeglasses, not enough money for senior citizens to have emergency dental care. But at the same time, they don't show, and in the House, it was about $500,000 we analyzed on abortions, that in many cases could be paid for by the male. We always talk about the poor female, but I just feel that it's unbelievable. We never bring up the responsibility of the male in this situation. And if we're going to make them responsible for the child that is allowed to be born, why not to be responsible for the child that is terminated in abortions? We have never had the legislative body taken direct action on that we will pay for abortion. This has always been an interpretation by the Attorney General, an interpretation by the Hess people, that since we provide Medicaid for people of need, then we address that. We complement those monies because we say we don't get enough money from federal government for the all medical needs. So we complement the budget. I don't know if it's $4 or $5 or $8 million. But the idea was to, when you have a shortage of federal Medicaid money, then we will pick it up under general relief medicine. A number of years ago, one of the department heads figured that, well, we can use this money for abortions since the federal government does not pick it up. And that has offended many people. It was not. Of course, the answer is, well, then we'll just drop medical relief money to complement Medicaid money. And that's not an answer, too. But I find ourselves in a really very uncomfortable situation now where the department denies senior citizens of medical dental service, emergency service, because they rather have elective abortions, which seems to be not questioned at all, be paid for first come, first serve. And that's a bad way to do medical assistance that we're supposed to be giving people. This is the logical thing, it seems to me to be logical and consistent with the other policies, especially if you're going to let a child be born. Then we take the individual to court, then we put them into the child enforcement curve, and then for 18 years the father has to pay for the child. I do like Representative Wolfberg Amendment. It's right on target. When I first read it, I was confused, and we did have a discussion about it. This does make the rapist, this was, does make the person that is charged for incest responsible for paying for that abortion. I am opposed to abortion, period. I'm even more opposed to being forced, and many people in our society are being forced, that our monies are being used for elective abortions. It's even more offensive when a person who has been charged of rape, convicted of rape, charged of incest, convicted of incest, gets away with us paying the bill while they're able to make dividends, they're able to make money in jail, and so on. We tap dividends for many other things, and Mr. Rothberg's amendment here is very rational in my mind. The other amendments I think I would have to disagree with. This one makes the parent or legal guardian of a minor liable. About 10 years ago, I got a call, and a couple other legislators got a call, where a mother was very, very outraged when she received a medical bill for her daughter to receive an abortion. She had no idea that had been done. Of course, the daughter, in confidentiality, went through the public health system and got the abortion. You can imagine that home when the daughter got home and her mother confronted her with this situation. It was really terrible, I'm sure, the emotions developed. So we did work it out that they would stop charging parents for abortions, especially when they were even consulted or involved. This is amendment, I'm sorry, Mr. Rothberg, I think almost touches upon the same thing. If we're going to have confidentiality in the situation, and if we're going to have judicial bypass because of whatever circumstances develop, I don't think that we're going to, I think it's a conflict of interest here when we introduce legislation that would make them responsible. It's not the parents who are responsible. And I know I have worked for kids for 10 years in boys' clubs, many at that age, 17 and 18, and there were a couple cases where there were pregnancy. But in my old age, it was the rightful thing to marry the woman and work those things out or let the child be for adopted. We didn't think much of abortion, although we know it was done. However, the parents in a lot of those cases were informed. There wasn't a protection, so to speak, as it is now for the young lady who is in a pregnancy problem. So I would respectfully disagree with the Second Amendment. Basically, and the fiscal note, which I know you're not going to be too involved with, is pretty high. They put down here $5.5 million, but I would disagree immediately with the other half because Medicaid money cannot be used for abortions. And in this case here, if there's anyone to pay for it, make the male responsible in this particular case. Let's try it. The legal aspect, I hope that I was wishing there'd be someone here from law instead of Hess, because that's the only thing in my mind we really need to look at. What is the legal aspect up here? If we can charge them for the child that lived, the male, you cannot charge them for the abortion.
My hearing is about as good as my eyesight.
Representative James.
I just have a couple questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Martin, do you know what the cost of an abortion usually is?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that they run anywhere from $300 to about $600. It's also my understanding that a lot of, especially in the Southeast, that the Public Health Service pays for the ladies to go out into Tacoma, Washington. I forget the clinic. I used to know the name of the clinic. And I guess there's a RFP. And they fly them down for one day and come back the same day. That's in addition to the abortion itself.
Representative James, follow up?
Well, yeah, just a follow up on that. I guess that didn't we pass a piece of legislation just last year or so on identifying the father in the case of a birth?
Yes, ma'am, we did. And that's where this comes from. We're using the same law, Chapter 47, that allows for that on the federal and state.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, if I could just have just a little bit more, I have to kind of say how I feel. I've always thought there were two people that make a pregnancy, and so therefore I thought it's a two people's responsibility whether to not have the child or to have the child, pay for the child if it happens to be born, or any other expense. It seems to me like. And I'm sorry I had to ask that question, because it seemed to me like that this is a good time. But my question is this. It's easy to determine, or not real easy, but it is a possibility to determine whether if the father says that I'm not the father, if the fellow says I'm not the father. If you have a child, you have some evidence, and there's a procedure where you can determine whether or not that is the father. What do you do with an aborted fetus? How do you figure out if that father says I'm not the father, then how do you determine that?
Madam Chairman, thank you. They can still take a DNA from that, I understand.
From what?
The DNA, is it? The sample of the cells of the aborted fetus.
Lord, what's the cost of that?
Yeah.
Anybody?
Well, that. I was wondering if fiscal note included that testing. And, I had a couple of other questions. And I certainly I think I concur with Representative James. I like to see fathers being held responsible. I have personal experience with a guardian ad litem who had dealt with a young man in Alaska who was very proud of the fact that he had produced 19 children with 11 different women. There probably needs to be even higher penalties than just the dividend, but in any case, discussing the male being involved is and financially responsible is a position I could support. But I heard you say that if they didn't have any money to take their dividend, particularly in the cases of rape or incest, but I believe current law says that people who are convicted of felonies do not receive dividends anyway. So am I incorrect in that?
Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chairman, when Mr. Wilkbrook and I discussed it, it was possible that that was already covered, but we wanted to be more explicit in this case here. I thought victims of crime, and we do have the special account for them, that could be paid for there. But this makes it explicit.
And
follow up
on it. And we don't have the amendment before us, but you were, because you had mentioned...
You should have.
Well, I mean, we haven't...
Oh, all right.
Officially, but if I will call those one and two, the long one one and the second one two, just for identification purposes. You didn't want to make the parents liable in your scenario as if they were unaware of the abortion. But would you consent to support an amendment that made the parents liable when they, as we've just passed legislation, would have then given consent for the abortion?
Mr. Chairman, I would be flexible there because I think that in a case like this here, in most cases, and maybe I'm narrow-minded on the old law where we want to keep it confidential from the parents. And so now that we've got the judicial bypass, I still feel uncomfortable in the confidentiality there. If a parent went to go ahead, there's nothing wrong with that at all for the parent to, and perhaps they may not even want their daughter to get involved in the government aspect of it, but just quietly and cheaper do it through private sources.
Oh,
yeah, thank you. Again, I guess my point was if someone who could not afford to provide an abortion for their daughter gave their consent, or the daughter couldn't afford the abortion, the parents give the consent, then shouldn't the parents then be financially responsible?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we're getting right back to the parties responsible. And in Boys Club, as I mentioned before, I've seen the most beautiful parents with the most wholesome situation on a given day. The kid did this or did that. It's something completely out of character, and you know they're adjust to it. But to make them responsible, especially in a case like this, and the child's making money like dividends, every one of them get dividends, maybe this would be a little way to curtail. You know, if they don't want to use preventive means that are available now, they're not willing to spend $1 or $2, whatever they cost, then maybe $400 for the abortion may teach him a little more conservative lesson, responsible lesson, I should say.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rookberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Martin, I appreciate your consideration of the amendments that I've offered to the committee. But before we get to the amendments, and I appreciate your point about the confidentiality, I think it's a point well taken. However, I'm concerned in light of the existing bill before us as it relates to the male of the
partnership.
There, right, if you will. Is not given the fact that we do have an existing
but unenforceable consent law in the books militate towards a requirement of confidentiality to a degree, but also would that not apply even to your bill without the amendment? Because if there is a situation where confidentiality would exist, and we have a situation where unfortunately there's a bill within the legislature's purview right now, but it has not become law, so it's difficult to deal with that, although we do have a confidentiality, or excuse me, consent provision on the books. I'm not sure how this works, but it would seem to me that the fact of the matter is that it may be a judgment on a part of people involved in a particular case where the confidentiality may be necessary also to the male member of party to your provisions of the bill. In other words, the father. There we go. How about that? The father. In other words, is there any requirement, or do you think there's any, or would under the, what is it, House Bill 24, the consent bill?
Oh, the one we passed, yes.
Right. Would, were that, given the hypothetical, if that were the case, that was law, with the provision for confidentiality and the provision for judicial bypass being proven, would that have any effect on your bill? Just as to the father is what I'm getting at, number one. And then we can speak further later about the amendment. But I think there's a correlation there in terms of this whole concept of confidentiality, and I appreciate you bringing it to the committee's attention. You know, I think we should be very careful and respect that confidentiality is what I'm suggesting. And I'm going to be, when I offer my amendment, is there a question?
Yeah.
I think there is. Mr. Chairman, if I could reposit the question. Representative Martin,
please do.
Given the bill that we passed, the legislature are about to, would that impact your bill as written here? And is there not a need to require that confidentiality as between the mother and the father?
Representative Martin?
Maybe I'm misconceiving the question, but I think the mother and father know each other. Except in rape and incest, and then of course if the person's criminal, we know. In chapter 47, where we're using this law at, and this is when a child is born, the mother-to-be is responsible for disclosing who the father was at the time of birth. And through Betty Davis, Representative Davis's law, about 4 years ago when we passed that, it seemed to be working pretty good. And that has helped the department very early determine the child enforcement laws. So that
on that point,
to that point, that is a voluntary paternity. It's not required. So
at the time of birth.
Plus, if there's an abortion, there's no birth. Excuse me. So I'm not sure how that works. I'm not familiar with the body of law that we're talking about and how that relates. I'm concerned about the confidentiality. It seems to me if there is a provision for consent even in our existing law, albeit no judicial bypass, that there seems to be even a regulatory requirement now for a level of confidentiality, which I think should be maintained. And I think that even would flow through to the father, not only to the parents as spoken to in the amendment that I would offer, but I think that confidentiality needs to be maintained. And I'm wondering if and apparently the bill sponsor doesn't agree with my theory that there is a constitution or legal requirement to maintain the confidentiality as it relates to the father, because I would say in the testimony earlier that many times we don't know who that father is. That's another question of evidence and or proof, however. I mean, there could be a dispute as to who the parenthood of the male in the act.
If you don't know, you don't know.
What's interesting? Well, oh, sorry, Berkowitz.
Very quickly, what do you know, being mindful of the privacy protection of the woman, what would happen if the woman didn't want to release the name of the father?
We're getting to the same thing. It's the same thing that we're happening with child enforcement services. It's only when they're applying for Medicaid that it comes into a problem. And then I don't know what the rationale is. I think that the mother who decides to keep the child, I don't know at what point they say, well, she cannot have Medicaid assistance or other welfare assistance because you refuse. But that came from the federal law, and that's what this is predicated on. If it's okay under federal law to disclose who the father is, and now state law, and that's been upheld, then why not for the abortion? And the confidentiality is right there within the department. Of course, when the child is born, more people know about it, and it's not that hard for grandparents. Like in the case of mine, where a couple of young grandparents wanted those children to be theirs, and it worked out. They know who the father was. But you can't answer every question. I don't intend to be a constitutional law here. The main thing is that we can make them responsible for the child that lived. Why not responsible for the abortion?
Would you envision a situation then where the state would be compelling the woman to disclose the identity of the father?
Mr. Chairman, I don't put it beyond the state for it to compel anything. The state has gone way out of bounds for many things, not only for child birth or abortion, but for others. We can always imagine government getting out of control. That's the reason why we have legislators to adjust. There will be those individuals who may, for one way or the other in the department, go beyond authority. So it's always there, sir.
Senator James?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an area of an issue that I have long been concerned about. And my reason for that is even when I was a young girl in high school and I would see another girl in high school getting pregnant, and of course being pregnant, soon everyone knows that, and the perpetrator, if I might call them that, goes scot-free. Girl has baby, he's gone. And I've always felt that there is an equal responsibility, and except in the case of rape or incest, that it takes two to tangle, and that at the very least it ought to be shared, and not the girl take the heat and the guy get away free.
And I
have to say that over the years it appears to me that if a guy, and I have to say that way, knew, they had to pay for their behavior, I think we might have a little more caution in that respect. But they know they're off free, and I really was supportive of the issue of trying to identify the father at the time of the birth of a child, because that's when the father's most vulnerable. If they're still hanging around, then later on they'll be gone. So I thought that's a good idea. I don't know. I'm not taking a position on this bill at this point in time until I really see what the unintended consequences are, other consequences, but I certainly support the concept that the man pays, or at least half. And I'm willing to divide it in half as a joint responsibility, but I am not willing to put it all on the woman. Mm-hmm. Or the girl, whichever it happens to be. I think whatever we can do, if we can do something in that area, certainly is a responsible way to go.
Well, thank you very much for that, and that's my whole sentiment too. We've got to make males more responsible in this state, in this country. They just get away scot-free, and you know how it easy when we were young and there's certain macho guys around schools or young men that are out of school, taking advantage of vulnerable young women, and they could care less.
In this state, we
can make them somewhat financially responsible.
We're losing our quorum, and we have two amendments and three people to hear from. So what I'm going to suggest is we take the testimony and come back to the amendments.
Thank you, sir. I'll stay here for that.
We have Carla Timpone.
can be available at any time, so I'd be happy to defer to the department people who may not.
Okay. Nancy Weller?
We have to go. We're going to the same meeting. Mm.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Weller with the Division of Medical Assistance, the Department of Health and Social Services. What House Bill 234 does in Section 3 of the bill is eliminate the ability of the department to fund abortions for low-income women.
To provide, I'm sorry.
It eliminates the department's ability to fund abortions for low-income women by placing abortions and related services as number one on the priority list in 4725-205. The department has not had sufficient financial resources to fund the first seven items on the existing list since 1986 due to budget reductions with the General Life Medical Program. The accompanying fiscal note that I prepared for the bill assumes that 80% of the women currently, the number of women currently receiving abortions would become Medicaid, would continue to bear the child, keep the child, become Medicaid eligible, and that the mother and the child would have their medical costs paid for by the state through the Medicaid program. Other sections of the bill related to financial responsibility and the garnishment of the permanent fund dividend checks to recoup the cost of abortion would not come into effect because of Section 3 of the bill, which eliminates the ability of the department to fund abortions. We do have a number of problems, administrative problems with these other sections related to garnishing the permanent fund dividend checks and for tracking the recipient's estate. We do not track people's estates and go after their estates in order to recoup costs. We would not have the ability to force a putative father to come in for DNA testing in order to determine whether they would be the father of the unborn child. Fetal DNA testing can be done by a laboratory in the state. It would cost $975 plus transportation for the parties. We would have to set up an administrative procedure for getting the fetal tissue from the facilities. Many abortions are done outside of the state, so it would be a significant administrative adventure dealing with setting up these procedures.
You said that we're funding many abortions now that are done outside the state?
Yes. Particularly in Southeast Alaska, people go to Seattle.
What would be the relative cost for someone to go to Seattle to have an abortion rather than have it in Juneau or?
I'm not sure whether anybody does them in Juneau. I think that's the reason a lot of people in Southeast Alaska go south, is there are no available facilities. Actually, the range of payments for abortion procedures, and there are many different procedures. Some of them are more related to dealing with miscarried situations or other kinds of birthing disasters. The payments that we have range between, I believe it's $365 and $900. When we pay for services out of state, we pay the Medicaid rate in the state where the service is provided, and they are significantly less than what we pay our fee schedule here in Alaska.
You don't pay transportation, or you do pay?
We do pay transportation as well. Yes, we paid for 737 abortions last year at a cost of $487,000. 300,000 of that was directly related to the abortions, and the other money was related to transportation and other services.
That's something around somewhere in an average of $500 each or something. And you said that you assumed that 80% of the people who would now be getting abortions would go ahead and deliver?
Yes.
That smacks then that there's a significant difference in, I mean, there's a, most of the abortions are performed on lower income people, is that, or that the state pays for?
The state only pays for low income people.
Okay, thank you.
Right. And you can argue with my assumptions, certainly, I mean.
No, I was just wondering how those were brought about, because that's an informational thing rather than a challenge. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I want
to
follow up on it. Ms. Waller, you're indicating that of all Medicaid-covered women who are pregnant, then now, presently, 80% do have abortions performed?
No, I'm saying that in preparing the fiscal note for the bill, the way I came up with this cost is that I was assuming that of the people who receive an abortion every year, 80% of those people would not
receive it, okay.
Have an abortion through their own means or some other means and would become Medicaid eligible, and that the Medicaid program would pay for the cost of the birth and for the child, because children receive automatic Medicaid eligibility for the first year of life when their mother is on Medicaid.
Would you characterize the fact that you're dealing now with the lower income group, and we're talking about trying to find the father, determined either through DNA sampling or some other voluntary disclosure or something, that how many of the either births or abortions would you have difficulty trying to find the father? In other words, the father is not voluntarily assuming part of his financial responsibility. I mean, I know you may not have statistics on that, but I'm just wondering, would you say it's like half of them or two-thirds?
Are you talking about the children that are born that we are paying?
Well, either those that are aborted or those that are born, this implies a certain number of people. And of those, if that number of people are the people that come to you for financial assistance, would you say that to determine the father of that group of folks, is the determination who the father is a other than a superficial review that, yeah, he did it and he agrees, a difficult thing to do on a small percentage of half of them, a large percentage?
For the Medicaid program and for public assistance programs, we operate under federal rules that require the woman to identify the father of the child, yes, to receive public assistance, cash assistance, or to receive Medicaid, unless they have special circumstances of which they're fear for their life, there's some abusive situation in which they don't have to identify the father.
Which would be, I guess, a small percentage of them, wouldn't it?
I would assume that. I don't know that for a fact. I mean,
so
I could.
Following up then. Finding the father really isn't the major problem that maybe some of the members of the committee heard earlier when we were talking about DNA sampling and all that. That's not a common thing, and normally you know who the father is.
I don't know what percentage would be in disagreement. I would, because, you know, when someone applies for cash assistance, the state has an obligation to go and get a child support order. Child support enforcement is required to issue an administrative order for child support for the children whose mothers are receiving assistance. And then the state and the federal government share the child support funds that are collected on behalf of the children that are on assistance.
Okay,
to recoup the amount of money that we're paying.
Yeah, I'm confused.
Assistance.
And I thought you said that was a requirement to determine the father.
It is a requirement. And the requirement is there because the state goes and gets a child support order against the father who is not supporting the child because they're on assistance.
Okay.
As far as for people, we've never looked at that for abortions. We've never tried to recoup any funds, so I couldn't make a comment.
No, it's just the fact that you know who it is, though. Yeah. Representative Roper.
Well, a couple of things, if I can get my questions formed properly. You've indicated that the requirement is to identify the father, but there are some special exceptions. You look at those on a case-by-case basis, or is there a statutory
a reference to or a regulatory reference to those, what would be the special exceptions to maintain the confidentiality? Is there a...
It's a federal law related
is there
a, to
is there
both
a criterion or is there specifically...
There is a criteria.
There is a criteria?
Don't know it off the top of my head, but there is a criteria for if the woman can assert that there is a danger to her life or to the children because of some abusive situation. I mean, she's not required to prove it.
If we could get the committee, if you could provide the committee with those references,
okay.
That would be helpful because it speaks to the bill itself.
I agree.
And then even my amendment. And then any contemplated amendments regarding that. I think that's important that we maintain that confidentiality and make sure that when we draft the legislation, it doesn't breach that.
Excuse me.
And the, oh gosh darn, another question here.
Well, if I could make a comment through the chair to Representative Brookberg, as I said at the beginning of my testimony, Section 3 would eliminate the ability of the department to pay for abortions so that the other sections in the bill related to responsibility, recoupment of PFD become moot because we would not be paying for abortions.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest, though, that under the definition about what abortion means, that the delivery of an unborn child prematurely preserve the life of a pregnant woman, wouldn't that allow you to perform some procedures?
Well, we are allowed under the Medicaid program using state and federal funds to pay for abortion services as a result of rape, incest, or danger to the life of the mother.
Right. So there would be, that would be a case where those would apply then, I guess.
So we could claim federal funds under the Medicaid program to pay for abortions in only those circumstances. Under the General Life Medical Program, the funding is used to pay for elective abortions. And as you heard this morning, we're operating under a consent decree since 1993 with the ACLU that we would not, in enforcing the GRM abortion regulations, require proving that there was a threat to the woman's life or that she had a psychological problem with the pregnancy in order for her to get the funding for the pregnancy. I have a copy of the consent decree that I can make available to you. These are very complex issues.
Now, is there anything in there that is proprietary at all? It's a matter of public record?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Martin?
Can I ask a question on financing?
All right.
Mr. Chairman, you brought up one good thing. I'm very glad to hear this, that we would perhaps save 590 lives of the 730 that are lost due to abortion. But you mentioned that you do not have enough money for other medical services needed. But if we would make the individual responsible for paying for the abortions, wouldn't that free up more money for the dental care we need for our seniors, for the eyeglasses, children?
I think we're digressing a little bit here.
Yeah, it's about $500,000 involved. And so as her rationale, why this shouldn't be, it seems to be a little mix. We'll be leaving more money.
I think the question, if we could get the parent or the father to pay, they would free up money. I think when we're starting to where that might go, I think we're digressing a little from the bill.
But at least it would free up money, sir.
Okay. Is that?
They're different programs.
Yes. But if obviously if we could get somebody else to pay, then that would free up money. I suppose that was the question. I'm so sorry.
Brookberg. Right. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Weiler, is there any requirements now that you look to the parents or the legal guardians for reimbursement of these procedures? Or does the child, if we will, no, it wouldn't be the child. You would have a unemancipated young woman that would come forward and request an abortion, but they would have to be already covered by Medicaid at that time. Is that correct?
Or would they, and their parents would also be? Or could a minor come to the department and request a Medicaid reimbursement for an abortion, even though her parents would not be eligible for Medicaid? Did I state that properly? Okay.
Through the chair to Representative Roquefort. A minor can come to the Division of Public Assistance because she's pregnant and apply for assistance to pay for an abortion procedure and claim that they want to remain confidential. They want their information to be confidential. They have not told their parents. And so in those circumstances, we would not request information on the parent's financial information in determining the eligibility of the minor, because we would be invading their confidentiality in order to do that.
And, Ms. Chairman, if I could follow up on that, then what if they didn't request confidentiality?
Then they would have to supply financial information from their parents because they were a minor.
And procedurally, you would seek reimbursement from the parents at that time or not?
Well, if the family was low income, then she could qualify for Medicaid assistance. If the family was over income because of the parents' income, then she would not be eligible.
Or the actual or initial anything. Grant. Would that be correct? You would look into that prior to allowing the procedure?
Yes, you have to be eligible before you.
So you determine eligibility prior to doing that, and part of that would be, if she didn't require the confidentiality, to look at her parents' capability or income eligibility level. So.
Right. Look at the family's income in order to determine eligibility. You have to be financially eligible, and you have to be pregnant.
Mr. Chair,
he's finished.
I'm done for the moment.
Anybody?
No, I'm sorry for my departure, but maybe you've covered this already, and we're asking for some projection or conjecture. If the parental consent bill passed, then when a minor comes to you and asks for financial assistance for an abortion, you would indeed then have to have judicial bypass or parental consent with her if she were below the age of 16. So that takes care of the confidentiality problem that currently exists.
It could impact the confidentiality, yes. They have to have parental consent.
Mm-hmm.
And I testified, I don't believe you were here
when I began
my testimony, but the effect of Section 3 of this bill would be to prevent the department from paying for abortion procedures altogether, because it places it as number one on the priority list for general relief assistance, and we have not paid through item number 7 on this list since.
Any other questions? We have Dr. Nakamura here. Thank you, Nancy.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, and I guess member of the committee.
Member of the committee.
I'm Dr. Peter Nakamura. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health, and I'd like to speak on this bill just from a health perspective. We've got a lot to learn from history. Before access to this procedure was available, and by access, we're talking about financial access, we're talking about legal access, and we're talking about medical access. We had a period of time where we had hospitals dedicated to doing nothing more than taking care of the complications of illegal back alley abortion procedures, self-induced abortions. Once we had legal access, and once we had medical access, we began to bring these numbers down to the point now where doing an abortion of any type is much safer than a normal delivery. Hard to perceive, but it's true. A normal delivery is much more dangerous than any abortion procedure. The financial access is a very significant issue here, and we're talking about a very vulnerable population of women who would not have access, despite the fact that it's legally possible, that medically it's now a very safe and available procedure. To take away that financial access is a very significant issue. It's like not having the law, and it's not like having the medical procedures. So I just want to speak and express my concern about HB 234 because it does mean access and decreased access. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Bundy.
Dr. Nakamura, I realize you're not a lawyer, but with the information that was just shared about it's now below the cutoff level of what we fund. It's a de facto defunding then of abortion. Would this then either bring legal suit to overturn this law if it were to become law, or legal court pressure to increase funding so that we would then fund far enough down the list that...
Yeah, I couldn't begin to speculate, but I would hope that what would happen is that something would happen to allow additional funds to come forward to make sure that these very highly vulnerable women do have access. So what would happen and what should happen are two different things, and I couldn't even begin to speculate. I'm sorry.
Why would a court require voluntary surgery?
Well, just Mr. Chairman, if I may. As I understand, and
I'm just wondering for me one question.
I've been now sitting in this chair almost long enough that I probably start to ask questions like a lawyer, but I'm far from that. As I understand now, the way federal law exists, because abortion is legal, we must provide it for people who cannot afford it. If I understand correctly, or at least that's the our attorney general's interpretation. So,
that is a hairy legal question.
And so now we've got a list of seven here. We only fund to seven. Abortion is number eight. So de facto, we have cut off funding. Now will the courts say either this legislation is flawed and it's thrown out, or you must put enough money in, or rearrange your priorities so that the money goes far enough down the list?
Representative Martin.
Mr. Chairman, many states do not provide for abortions. Many states don't. We can get that from Right to Life or AUL in Chicago, the whole list of states that do not cover abortions.
So it's not a federally mandated.
Yeah, it's
you can have your freedom, but pay for them.
It's Alaska.
So your concern is that Alaska statute would have to either be revised, or there's a conflict, or this might be held unconstitutional. And, not unconstitutional, yeah. but in conflict.
And again, what little I understand about this, I get apparently Alaska's attorney general has said we must provide access to all, even those who cannot afford. And understand, I think people should be able to pay for the services that they want, and I'm opposed to elective surgery of any kind that is state-funded, but in any case. If the state Supreme Court, and I would guess that they support this, or a challenge would have been brought to them by now, says that we must provide access including financial support if that's necessary. Then by listing the portion of the bill that lists abortion below the cutoff level would deny access, and so then this bill would be unconstitutional. Or courts might say, and this is more far-fetched, you must put more money into the HES budget so that the money goes far enough to reach these levels.
I can understand your reluctance to try and get into law. Are there any other questions for Dr. Nakamura?
Well, and how many angels do dance on the head of a
Yeah, man? Right.
I have an answer for that one. Thank you.
If Deborah Barr, her bear.
I'm Deborah Bear. I'm Assistant Attorney General. I'm normally here as Regulations Attorney, but in my past I have advised the Medicaid program and the General Relief Medical Program. Oh, okay. I'm hoping that I can help you a little bit today.
Yes,
I also was counsel when Governor Hickel was doing his abortion regulations. So I have done some considerable research in this area. What I'd like to do is try to help you a little bit about it, because it is a very complex area of law, and frankly, the answer differs what state you're in. The federal, when the Medicaid program first came in to federal government, Medicaid funded abortions pretty wide open. Congress cut that back and only covered it in cases of rape, incest. On occasion, it was rape, incest, life of the mother, various varieties. It's usually done by a rider on the appropriation bills in Congress. What happened was there were major suits all over the United States on whether Congress could do that. In other words, was it fair to discriminate against poor people? These cases went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, and the answer at the United States Supreme Court was that this is a benefit. Congress can decide what level of benefit that they want to fund and pay, and that was fine under the federal law. What happened was a second wave of course case decisions came out in the states with constitutional rights of privacy. The case decisions in this area came out different. And I frankly, in the time that I had to prepare, I can give you more sites if you need them later. But generally what they said in states with a constitutional right of privacy, as Alaska has, that the state does not have to fund any service. But if the state chooses to fund a service and enters into a zone of what they call its privacy, the state must do so with neutrality. In other words, if the state funds pregnancy services, they have to fund the other side of the coin, which is abortion services. There's decisions in Connecticut. There are decisions in a couple of other states that I can provide to your counsel if you need them. When I was assisting Governor Hickel in drafting the regulations, I was looking at options, and one of the things that most of the states in those areas said, at minimum, you've got to cover therapeutic abortions. This bill does not cover therapeutic abortions. It only covers, takes into account the to the health of the mother, I think it's the death of the mother or something like that. So it truly does not address those kinds of cases. At the time when we put out the regulations, we knew we were into a gray area in the state of Alaska, because we have no case decisions in this area. The regulations came out, and we were in court within hours. Your own legislative counsel looked at these regulations, and I have memos in my files from 1982 essentially saying the regulations that Governor Hickel put in were unconstitutional. I would suggest strongly that you have your own counsel look at this bill and see if her conclusion has changed based on those decisions.
Did you say 82 or
92? 92.
Okay.
92. I'm wondering if I could provide any more information for you that might help under the situation.
Do you have those case sightings? You said you would make those available to you.
Yes, I can speak with your counsel later and help you on it. It's a difficult area of the law. It really is.
And as I understand what you're saying, if you enter, you don't have an obligation to enter in. But if you do, then you have to do both sides of the coin.
Right. That's the basic problem of a question with a constitutional right of privacy. And there have been constitutional amendments proposed on the ballot. I think you've worked on this, Representative Martin, in the past, to try to stop state funding for abortions. And they have not passed the electorate. I think there was one before. So it's I'm fairly certain that this type of bill would not pass constitutional muster in the state.
Representative Martin.
There was one case in 1982 where it was brought before the people, financing of public education, and it did not pass. But in this case here, Deborah, I was wondering, even though you say the state has a responsibility to finance abortion, we are not limited to the source of where the revenue comes from, are we?
I'm confused. The Division of Medical Assistance cannot fund any abortion without an appropriation.
Right.
So in that way, the state of Alaska has to fund abortions because it has to be done through an appropriation process.
Okay. And if we are appropriating money from the parent, from the father who's responsible for the pregnancy, what's wrong with that?
I think the basic problem, I can tell you, I've had many hats in my life, but one of them, I've been a child support attorney. And it's very difficult establishing paternity of a child. It's very difficult once you establish paternity of a child doing collection of it. Oftentimes the amount of money that you're talking about in the case of an abortion is the cost of collection, the cost of court action, and the cost of DNA. I'm not sure that you'd have, I'm not sure that they'd necessarily net out.
Mr. Chairman.
Now, just a minute. Ms. Weller indicated that we do need to know who the father is.
Right.
It's difficult to determine who the father is.
I can tell you, I've litigated cases, and what will usually happen is, in a situation like that, there's a number of people that will commit and sign the line and say legally they are the father of the child. In this kind of a situation, I would say it's probably that's a rare case. And so what it would mean is going through blood testing, DNA testing, and whatever to figure out whether, in fact, that person is legally responsible for the child. And then even if you are able to establish it, the cost of collection, does the person have any money to pay?
So are you saying that is more common than not, or that that's a rare case?
I think given the type of person that applies for general relief medical assistance is the kind of person who probably is probably lower income. Well, definitely it's got to be the lower income bracket. I would say it's better. I would say it's better than 50-50 that you would have to have some kind of litigation to establish the paternity of it. It may be done at a very early stages through DNA testing, and not you wouldn't necessarily have to go through the whole court thing of it. But admissions, certainly the gentleman could admit if he wanted to,
mm-hmm.
but he doesn't have to.
Okay, we're back to the confusion state then, because sure. I thought the earlier testimony was that we did determine who the father was, and that was not 50-50. It was far higher than that.
Okay. When a woman applies for public assistance, she has to name a person, uh-huh. whether she's right, wrong, or otherwise.
Oh,
she still has to name.
Oh, there's a name, but not necessarily.
Yeah, and I've done cases where, frankly, the woman wasn't sure. She had to name someone, so she names someone, and it turned out it really was one of three or four people. And so I've had to do DNA testing of three or four people to establish who the father is.
Thank you. Representative Martin.
Mr. Chairman, I sit on the budget for the past 4 years of the Child Enforcement Services, and I'm glad to because that's where this concept developed. And I know they're having a lot more success than what was anticipated. All the fears that are being brought up now were brought up about forcing a poor woman to disclose who the father was. And every person, I imagine, is disclaiming, no, no, no. But it doesn't seem to take that much to when the child is born. That's where they really get them. They want to see who the child was. And that's okay. At least they're becoming human, finally, and maybe want to take care of their obligation. So the cost involved in finding out who the father was has diminished significantly. Secondly, as far as collection is concerned, we know every person in this state that gets a permanent fund dividend check. We access those. The state does for many, many reasons. For your failure to pay for your college loan, legal fines, automobile fines. The state is so easy for them to enter the name of an individual and put a lien against their dividend check.
If they can prove that that's the father.
Right, yeah. Once up there. So the collection is minor.
Yeah, I don't think that was the question.
But the main thing is that the disclaimer of who the father is, I think that the child enforcement law is working very well. And one important reason why it's working now, the state gets an incentive. The more cases we find pay in, and last year the federal government gave the state $2.1 million incentive because of the successful rate in finding the fathers. So we see there is a good thing there, making these fathers responsible, and that's another reason later on in another department we'll talk about the fiscal note, because you can't say that 80% of the kids will be welfare cases when they're having such good success now in finding who the fathers are and make them take them off of welfare.
Thank you. Any other questions? Deborah? Carla, you had graciously given up your first position here.
I was going to say thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, but I won't.
Well,
For the record, my name is Carla Timpone, and I'm representing the Alaska Women's Lobby. The Women's Lobby is unequivocally opposed to any piece of legislation that limits a woman's right to choose to access a safe and legal abortion. Above and beyond that, the Women's Lobby has some very particular and specific concerns about this particular piece of legislation. The way the bill is currently drafted, a woman who applies for GRM to pay for an abortion must name what, in this case, we have to call the putative father, unless the department determines that she has good cause not to do so. The definition of good cause as outlined by the amendment that Representative Roekberg had drafted includes rape or incest. Quite frankly, the Women's Lobby would like to see that definition not just be limited to rape or incest, but to be left the way the language is currently in the bill, because we feel it's broader. There are many women who are victims of domestic violence who find themselves in life-threatening situations, and we would not like them to be excluded from the good cause definition by limiting it to rape or incest. The woman then has to assign to the department the right of recovery to the funds to pay for this service. We're concerned, and we don't think that it's outside the realm of possibility that this could happen, that a woman will name a putative father. Of course, he won't be found, because that is far and away most often the case. The woman's PFD...
You say far and away. Is that because the person has gone, or that this is a fictitious name, or...?
I would say either.
Okay.
And especially in a case of an aborted fetus, it's my understanding, and I'm certainly not a medical expert, but I'm assuming that unlike paternity establishment that's used by the Child Support Enforcement Division, which is most of the time a blood test because you're dealing with two live people, in the case of a fetus, you would have to use fetal tissue for purposes of testing. So paternity establishment couldn't happen until after the fact anyway. And of course, while I'm on that, that assumes that, like the Child Support Enforcement Division, the Division of Public Assistance has at its disposal a team of employees whose only job is to locate absent parents, which I do not believe the Division of Public Assistance has. We've heard testimony that when a single woman comes in to apply for public assistance, she must give them the name of the father, and that is absolutely true. However, that pretty much ends the responsibility of the Division of Public Assistance. They get the name, they pass it on to Child Support Enforcement, and Child Support Enforcement picks it up from there. At least the way I read the bill, that is not going to be the case here. It seems to me because the bill does not say that anybody else is responsible, I'm assuming that the Division of Public Assistance, Department of Health and Social Services would be responsible for doing that location. And I am not sure that they have staff that do that or are even qualified to do that. So the woman has to assign her right of recovery to the department. If the father cannot be found and or made to pay, then the woman's PFD is garnished. What happens then if the father is located? The woman can't recover a portion of what was taken from her financially to pay for the procedure because she's assigned her right of recovery to the department. It doesn't say that that right is null and it doesn't say that that assignment is null and void once and if he is found. So in other words, the woman's PFD is garnished to pay for the entire amount of the procedure. Dad suddenly turns up or she finds him. She is prohibited from seeking at half the cost of the procedure because she's assigned her right of recovery to the Department of Health and Social Services.
Why would that preclude her from getting back whatever the half was from the husband?
From whom should... Because she's assigned the right of recovery of the payment to the department.
From the permanent fund dividend.
Right. So
she gives that up, and then they find me. Why can't I repay her?
You could voluntarily.
Well, okay.
But if you don't choose to voluntarily, she has no legal recourse to try to get it because she's assigned her right of recovery. to the Department of Health and Social Services. So we have a concern about that. We also have some concerns about the nature of singling out this particular procedure because it is an elective procedure, or in any case, that's how it's been characterized. I believe that there is a possibility that there are other circumstances under which treatment is paid for under GRM for people who suffer a medical condition or an injury as a result of a situation over which they had control. For instance, if a homeless alcoholic falls asleep on the curbside and is run over by the garbage truck and requires medical treatment as a result of his choice to drink himself into stupefaction, I might have some problems with the states paying for treatment of that person. I think that we start to go down a slippery slope when we start to prohibit some medical procedures because we have moral or religious problems with that particular kind of procedure, because there's a wide spectrum of procedures that different ones of us could have moral or religious problems with. Someone who is GRM eligible steals a bike, takes a ride without a helmet, suffers a head injury. Is the state obligated to treat that person? Some of us might have a problem with that. So we have a concern in that regard. And while I understand that what the sponsor is trying to get to, and don't disagree at all, is an equality of responsibility, I think then we also have to address equality of class, for lack of a better word. The bill's not a referendum or a statement on abortion. It's a statement on who we feel deserves to have one. It's okay to have an abortion if you can afford to pay for it out of your pocket. It's not okay to have an abortion if the state has to pay for it. I think we begin to get into a whole other set of issues there that relate primarily to class, and we certainly have some concern with that as well.
Don't we suffer from that anyway, though, whether or not I have insurance? If I have insurance or have some other means, if I break my leg and I want a private room as opposed to a ward, don't we have this class distinction anyway?
Well, to a degree, you're still receiving the medical service. You may just be receiving it in nicer surroundings.
Okay. You indicated that the inebriate that gets run over by a truck you have a problem with, or the guy that decides to walk on a high wire between two buildings and, and falls and breaks his leg, you have trouble with the state paying for that, but yet here is a voluntary, and I don't want to get off on the rights of abortions or not, but it seems to me that was a decision, unless it was rape, where there was a voluntary copulation, that was a high-risk venture that didn't go right, just like the high wire walker.
Right.
In one case, the state should pay, in the other case, he shouldn't pay.
No, I'm saying that if the
moral issue.
No, actually, Mr. Chairman, I'm saying if the state's going to pay in one case, then I think it needs to pay in the other.
Or if it doesn't pay in one case, it maybe shouldn't pay in the other. At any rate,
I think there should be equality involved there.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to ask you something. I forgot what it was.
I'll be around.
Bowie.
I have that pop.
It was some information I wanted to find out from you. Alzheimer's.
I can leave my name and phone number with your staff if you think of it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there Representative Martin, do you have any questions for?
No, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any other people that you know of that might want to testify? I thank you for standing by. Apologize. We're in that time of the year when the committees are all stretched several different ways, and they all had a... I'm late for another committee meeting. There isn't anyone else to testify, but if it would be possible, when we get to deliberating this in the committee, if we could perhaps, if questions come up, I don't expect you to have to come back again, but since there are some questions, obviously, that the committee is really not knowledgeable about, either by phone or something, could we take that liberty to contact you? Well, thank you. With that, I'm adjourned at 16 minutes to 4.